The Maharshi and Krishnamurti. This is a 1967 Mountain Path letter to the editor. I didn't read that one, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you did read it.
But this is a continued.
Oh, okay.
I think there was another letter in there.
Okay.
In answer to a letter on this subject on page 258 of your July issue, you say Krishnamurti tells you to follow the path of no guru, but just to be in a state of effortless, choiceless awareness. Well, try that first. If you can do it, well and good. You need nothing else, but I have never yet met anyone who could. Yes, I did read that in part two. Okay. If not, then Maharshi tells you either to practice self-inquiry, submit to God, or Guru. So try that. Now, in order to be fair, you should also say whether you have met anyone. I read that, yeah. Okay. But here's another one, the grace of Bhagavan. It is now 10 years since I stepped in at the ashram on my way down from Calcutta and spent a few happy hours in Sri Bhagavan's hallowed hall. I felt once again the dynamic grace almost overpowering me as during the days and nights I spent at his blessed feet. This is the Venkataraman Niger coil. So often in those days I would be awakened by him at night and told some remarkable incident from his life or some spiritual truth of deep significance. His sayings are still ringing in my ears, stirring me as then. His paternal love and attention to my personal needs has no parallel and has enthralled me. Once when I took leave of him, he said, "You think you go here and there of your own accord? But all your movements are only here," pointing to his chest. "Just as the pictures in the cinema are only on the screen." Since then, I have always felt his statement to be literally true. I have never been able to get away from him. In your wonderful book on him, you say, referring to me, "Indeed, the thought of remembrance of Bhagavan began to accompany him everywhere, to be inseparable from him. But now I feel him always and wholly in me and enjoined by him. I can never think of anything else, wherever I may be. Just this morning, while reading about Sri Bhagavan's unique love in the inspiring pages of the special Jayanti number of the Mountain Path, January 1966, tears came to my eyes. Sri Bhagavan's dynamic grace courses through this journal like a torrent. It is certain to flood the world with the peace and happiness which is so urgently needed." V. Venkataraman. Editor, please share more of your reminiscences with our readers. Many are avid for them.
Many are what?
Avid. Another letter from C. Shiva Kumar, Berkeley, California. "On the evening of the 28th June, I dreamed of Sri Bhagavan. On waking, I wrote down the dream as follows. I was in Tiruvannamalai and saw Sri Bhagavan approaching on foot from a considerable distance. He slowly descended some steps and walked toward where I was standing. There were others with me. He came very close, but although I looked at him intently, he did not seem to look directly at me. I was aware that some of those in the group were trying to make arrangements with the man in charge that they would sit where Sri Bhagavan would see them and perhaps talk to them directly. I was not involved in all this. Then a voice said to me, 'Why all this? You know the path, follow it.' Then I awoke. If, in your opinion, there is any hidden meaning in this, I would be very glad of your interpretation. The dream was exceptionally vivid, and even now I can recall it very clearly. Editor, how could there be any hidden meaning in it? It is so clear and outspoken. You know the path, follow it, just as Bhagavan might have spoken in his lifetime. Perhaps you were a little despondent, thinking others received his guidance directly, while to you it came only indirectly. And that was the reply. There's a letter from Arunachala Bhakta Bhagavan. 1967. With Sri Bhagavan's grace and blessing, the mountain path has already become one of the most important orderlies in its own field. Whosoever reads the mountain path finds it so deeply inspiring and enlightening that he becomes a friend of the magazine. In the Ashram Bulletin and letters to the editor, there flows so much of Bhagavan's grace that I myself first go through these departments before reading anything else. Sometimes we feel the need of getting full mailing addresses along with their experiences. That is for you to decide. And if it has not been done so far, there must have been a valid reason for omitting them. He's trying to find some devotees. Personally, for me, it never occurs to me that Bhagavan is not in body. The magazine transmits so much of Bhagavan's ever-shining life and teaching to all of us that Bhagavan's grace and blessings change our mundane life to that of a spiritual one. So, this is Arunachala Bhakta Bhagavan, Arunachala Ashram, Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi Center, 78 St. Mark's Place, New York City. At the first rented a room, a second floor there. That was the first location. The last issue, they had the picture of the group. Editor, we are very glad to hear of the enthusiasm shown by the devotees of Arunachala Ashram in New York City. We are certainly willing to give the full mailing addresses of authors of letters, but we do not do so unless specifically asked us. Some of them prefer to be unknown. Ritual continued. I am happy, this is by Professor K. Swaminathan, Nitya's grandfather. You know, Anand's wife,
oh, really?
Nitya, that's her grandfather.
Nitya's mother's side.
Yeah, well, Nitya's mother is a daughter.
Yeah, but mother's father.
Yeah. I am unhappy about your note under ritual. I, on page 259, ritual, 259 of the last issue. This reflects the shadow cast rather than the light shed by the lamp. In other words, the ashram rather than Bhagavan. There was no difference between Brahmins and non-Brahmins. This is a Brahmin writing. There was an article about the Brahmins there. There was no difference between Brahmins and non-Brahmins in the pre-ashram days. After the ashram came into being and got organized, Orthodox Brahmins sat separately at meals, and Bhagavan did not object. Others, including well-known Brahmins, sat near Bhagavan in the general and larger section. To this too, Bhagavan did not object. Your statement, quote, Bhagavan expected each person to live according to the conventions of his family, social and religious background, unless they took sannyas, which he did not encourage people to do, unquote, is a grossly misleading formulation of Bhagavan's attitude to both varna and ashrama. Followers of the Kanchi Aracharya, who would welcome this formulation, and followers of Mahatma Gandhi, whose social background demanded disregard of caste and differences, he was assigned by Indira Gandhi to produced the collective works of Mahatma Gandhi. He made 99 volumes.
Oh,
Swami. Professor K. Swaminathan.
What is the IAS?
Of course.
Really?
Yeah, Professor K. Swaminathan.
Yeah, but no, I was an Indian administrative service, like the...
No, he was the president of a college. He was an English professor. Professor Swaminathan.
Which year was this, Dennis, when he wrote the letter?
This year is 1967. We came to Bangalore in 1940 or so. He was with Mahatma Gandhi. He criticized Bhagavan. He thought, first, what is this man sitting up there doing nothing and this whole country is...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did that.
then he went there and then everything changed. He was a Gandhi. Okay. This formulation, the followers of Mahatma Gandhi, whose social background demanded disregard of the caste, both groups were perfectly at home in Bhagavan's presence. On scores of occasions, I sat at meals in the general section, it is wrong to call it the non-Brahmin section, where several Brahmins joined us for the opportunity they thus enjoyed of partaking of the food served by the Mudaliar lady, that Bhagavan expected anything or in anybody is simply not true. Again, though it is true that unlike Swami Vivekananda, Bhagavan did not encourage people to take sannyas in any formal sense, he did encourage people developing detachment and renunciation. As when caste differences slipped off and there was no arrogant claim that one was a reformer. What or in what company one ate did not matter to Bhagavan. This is when he's in New Delhi.
60s, it was still
40s, 50s, 60s. An editor. Wow, he wrote a long answer to this one. First, the general question whether Bhagavan expected anything about anyone. There certainly was a general impression of aloofness, but when one saw the disapproval he showed at any improper conduct and the gracious encouragement he gave to meditation, it became evident that in fact he expected that at the very highest of us. His silent disapproval could be terrible, and his smile of approval brought sheer joy to the fortunate recipient. Then that he expected each person to live according to the conventions of his family, social and religious background, the fact that the followers of the Kanchi Acharya with an orthodox background, and those of Gandhi with an unorthodox background, both felt at home in his presence, far from contradicting this, exemplifies it. In individual cases, the fact that Bhagavan rebuked a young Brahmin of an orthodox family who wanted to sit among the non-Brahmins at meals, as related in the article above Orthodoxy and Unorthodoxy, 1965 October issue, and yet said nothing to Professor Swaminathan when he sat among the non-Brahmins exemplifies it. Also, the present ashram policy, far from clashing with Bhagavan's attitude, continues it. Brahmins who wish to eat separately are allowed to do so, but, for instance, S.P. Mukherjee, a Brahmin whose photograph appears in our ashram bulletin of July 1964, regularly eats among the non-Brahmins when he takes his meals at the ashram. So does our occasional contributor and former trustee, Dr. T.N. Krishnaswamy. Bhagavan would formulate no general rule either for or against orthodoxy. Once an Arya Samajist, an ardent social reformer, tried persistently to get Bhagavan to condemn caste distinctions, but Bhagavan, as reported in talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi, page 592 to 596, held firmly to the spiritual view of reality and refused to be drawn into making any social or political statement. Similarly, when an enthusiast or Harijan uplift told Bhagavan, as reported by Devaraj Mudaliar, Day by Day, that Mahatma Gandhi had expressed approval of marriages between Harijan girls and higher caste bridegrooms, and asked Bhagavan to add his approval, Bhagavan refused, saying that it was not his dharma to interfere in such matters. Coming to the last paragraph of the letter, it is of course true that Bhagavan encouraged detachment and renunciation, but it does not necessarily follow that renouncing caste discipline is a sign of inner renunciation. It may be, but there may be other motivations also. And as stated above, Bhagavan did not encourage people to renounce their caste discipline. It is not true to say that, quote, what or in what company one ate did not matter to Bhagavan, unquote. When anyone asked him to declare, he declared quite definitely that a vegetarian diet was more conducive to spiritual progress, as reported at various places in the talks. Devaraj Majariya was one who asked him and received this assurance, as he relates in his book, My Recollections of Bhagavan Sri Ramana. It was characteristic of Bhagavan, however, that he did not make general rule that his followers should be vegetarians. He did come very near to it when he wrote as the conclusion of to self-inquiry, it is within our power to adopt a sattvic diet and, with earnest and incessant endeavor to eradicate the ego, the cause of all misery. He formally used the expression a sattvic diet to mean vegetarian. Here's one of the hallucinogenic drugs. Continued. This is a big topic back then.
1967.
Right about times, they
are psychosomatic vehicles. This is a question by G.N. Daly from Haworth, Yorkshire. Our psychosomatic vehicles are progressing through effort and experience to the point when there will be no barrier to the natural state of realization. A drug may be capable of blasting a way through the barrier so that a glimpse of self may be obtained. But in doing so, it will damage the vehicle. The sight will necessarily cease when the mean to it is withdrawn, and it will be necessary to make a new start on the path with a damaged vehicle plus karmic difficulties you cannot carry with karmic difficulties. You cannot carry water in a leaky bucket. Even the sight of the self, which is obtained by means of drugs, is not a true, but an ersatz sighting. You
know, ersatz means instead of, replacement.
How is it spelled? E-R?
Yeah, S-A-T-Z.
Wow.
Ersatz sighting. This may sound contradictory, but it is true. The Guru's grace is the only true means to spiritual sight. Editor, true, but Bhagavan did not even grant requests that were made to give a pre-glimpse through grace. He was training his disciples in the more important, though less spectacular task of making the vehicle capable of sustaining the experience when it is attained. Another letter by K from Madras.
That's it, all the hallucinogenic thing drugs.
What?
The hallucinogenic, that's it, nothing more.
This is part two, you missed.
Just
this
get a
is
glimpse
part one.
Okay. So is it a real glimpse?
Well, here's two. And they said, this is John Holt from Bristol, England. I see from the middle way that the London Buddhist Society refuses admission to its meditation classes to anyone who takes psychedelic drugs. What is your reaction to that? Editor. They are to be congratulated on their firm stand. Okay, next letter. Contradictory. In writing the editorial Total Therapy in the July 1967 issue of The Mountain Path, the editor has overlooked verse 13 of the supplement to 40 verses of Bhagavan. Verses 14 and 15 may also be referred to in this connection as also Upadesharam, verse 10. Also the statement in the same editorial, quote, but they, powers, will not be deliberately acquired, unquote, would seem to contradict Bhagavan's reference to Chudala in Tripura Rahasya, acquiring powers, siddhis, deliberately in order to convince her husband, the prince, after she herself became, excuse the word, self-realized. Also, in connection with the editorial reply to a letter on page 258 in the same issue, kindly see Ramana Nuul Tiratu, The Collected Works of Bhagavan in Tamil, and the following page is also Upadesha. Editor, K seems to object to two statements. One, that powers are not to be deliberately acquired or to be valued if they come, and two, that the Maharshi seldom, if ever, actually recommended it, japa, but when asked, he gave permission to use it. On both counts, he is wrong. The Maharshi consistently deprecated the desire for powers. His attitude was, as given in the translation of the Devikulatara, let him not accept thaumaturgic powers, even when directly offered to him, for all these are like ropes to tether a beast, and they will certainly drag him downward. Supreme liberation does not lie that way. It is not found elsewhere than in infinite consciousness. With regard to japa, it has never been stated in the mountain path that the Maharshi did not approve of japa or that he denied its validity. Only it has been stated, and rightly, that he did not prescribe it in the first place, but only to those who asked his authorization to use it. Even one of the quotations which K gives, Upadesar, verse 4, supports this statement by showing how the Maharshi classed japa, incantation, as of less value than meditation, self-inquiry. The verse runs, this is certain. Worship, incantations, and meditations are performed respectively with the body, the voice, and the mind, and are in this ascending order of value. None of the other verses he refers to support his objections. In fact, verse 14 of the supplement of 40 verses asserts that self-inquiry is the essence of all paths, while verse 15 decisively compares a man who values powers to a lame man who boasts that he can dispose of the enemy if only someone will hold him up on his feet. Both tell against his objections. And here's the editorial called Total Therapy. Man as we know him in the world today is in an imperfect state which Christianity refers to as fallen. That is to say that he is deprived of the sublime awareness and resplendent powers which are his birthright. It is not the fault of any individual man that he grows up so, but is the fault of mankind as a whole, since it is only through neglect and misuse that powers are lost. Therefore, Christianity calls it sin, but original sin, the sin or fault lying on mankind as a whole and causing its fallen state. Although an individual did not bring this unworthy state upon himself, he can, with right guidance and persistent effort, rectify it and recover his lost birthright. According to Christian teaching, he can be redeemed from it by the Christ born in his heart. I quoted in a previous editorial that very profound saying of Angelus Celestius. Quote, Christ may be born 1,000 times in Bethlehem, but he is not born anew in your own heart, but he be not born anew in your own heart, you remain eternally forlorn. The scriptures of the various religions are an exhortation to break free from this fallen state and an indication of what this implies and how it can be done. To wait for death in the hope that it will be done for you is a
pusillanimous.
Pusillanimous. Attitude. No kidding. This life is the opportunity for doing. There are many ways of setting about it, but they can be grouped broadly into the positive and negative. Wow.
What's the meaning of it? It's trivial, silly.
Bhagavan and yoga. The source of breath is the same as that of the mind. Therefore, the subsidence of either of them leads effortlessly to that of the other. The practice of stilling the mind through breath control is called yoga. Not here in America. Fixing their mind on the chakras or psychic centers, yogis roam for any length of time without awareness of their bodies. As long as this state continues, they appear to be immersed in some kind of joy. But when the mind, which has been stilled, becomes active again, it resumes its worldly thoughts. It is therefore necessary to train it with practices like dhyana, meditation, whenever it becomes externalized. It will then attain a state in which there is neither subsidence nor emergence. Yoga means union, and therefore implies prior division and subsequent reunion of one with the other. But who is to be united with whom? You are the seeker, and you seek union with something. So this something must be separate from you. But yourself is intimate to you. Seek it and be it. Then it will expand into the infinite, and there will be no question of union. First, find out who it is that has viyoga, separation, before you talk about yoga, union. Yoga means union and is only possible when there is prior viyoga. A person is now under the delusion of viyoga, and this must be removed. Whatever method of removing it is used can be called yoga. Question. Which is the best method? Bhagavan. That depends on the temperament of the aspirant. Each person is born with the samskaras from his past lives. One person will find one method easy and one another. Nothing definite can be said for all. Yoga aims at union of the individual with the universal, that is, the reality. This reality cannot be new. It must exist already. And it does exist. Therefore, the path of knowledge tries to find out how viyoga, separation, came about. It is only separation from the reality. That means illusion. What you have to do is to find out who has the illusion. Then it will vanish. Generally, people want to know about illusion without asking who it is that has the illusion. That is foolish. Illusion, maya, is outside you and unknown, whereas the seeker is within and known. So find out first what is integral to you before trying to find out what is foreign to you and unknown. K.M. Jivarajani asked, I sometimes concentrate in the brain center and sometimes in the heart. Not always in the same center. Is that wrong? Bhagavan, wherever you concentrate, in whatever center, there must be a you to concentrate. And that is what you must concentrate on. Different people concentrate in different centers, not only the brain and the heart, but also in the space between the eyebrows, the tip of the nose, the tip of the tongue, the lowermost chakra, and even external objects. Such concentration may lead to a sort of laya, in which you feel a certain bliss, but care must be taken not to lose the thought, I am, in all this. You never cease to exist in all these experiences. Jivarajani, that is to say that I must be a witness? Bhagavan, talking of the witness should not lead to the idea that there is a witness and something else apart from him that he is witnessing. The witness really means the light that illumines the seer, the seeing, and the process of seeing, before, during, and after the triads of seer, seeing, and seeing. The illumination exists. It alone exists always. Desai asks, how can one direct the prana, or life current, into the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel, so that, as prescribed in the Ramana Gita, one can achieve the severance of the Chitjara Granthi, the knot between the body and the consciousness? Bhagavan, by asking, who am I? The yogi may be definitely aiming at rousing the Kundalini and sending it up the Sushumna. And the jnani may not have this as his object, but both alike achieve the same result of sending the life force up the Sushumna and severing the Chitjara Granthi. Kundalini is only another name for Atma, or self, or Shakti, force. We speak of being inside the body because we conceive of ourselves as limited by this body. But, and it is really both inside and outside, being no other than the self, or the Shakti, force of the self, the Sai. How can one churn up the nadis, the subtle channels, so that the Kundalini may go up the Sushumna? Bhagavan, though the yogi may have his methods of breath control, postures, etc., the jnani's method is only that of self-inquiry. When the mind is merged in the self, by this method, the self or its Shakti or Kundalini rises automatically. Kundalini is one name given by the yogic people to what may be called the Atmak Shakti inside the body. The followers of Vichara, self-inquiry, call the same power jnana, knowledge. The bhakta, devotee, calls it love or bhakti. This is all about yoga. Everybody writes a long article. Sri Ramana, meditation is your true nature. You call it meditation now because there are other thoughts distracting you. When these thoughts are dispelled, you remain alone. That is, in the state of meditation free from thoughts. And that is your real nature, which you are now trying to gain by keeping away other thoughts. Such keeping away of other thoughts is now called meditation. But when the practice becomes firm, the real nature shows itself as true meditation. Big articles on yoga. Sri Bhagavan, there is only one consciousness. If you talk of individual consciousness, you have to concede a cosmic consciousness. In your dream, you recognize the kingdom and a king and a rule of law to which you bow. It is the same with what is called cosmic consciousness. Mona Diksha, R.G. Kulkarni. About 20 years back, an urging came to me to have darshan of a Mahatma who was a Jivan Mukta. And I was in search of a Mahatma. I was in search for one when I happened on a small book in Gujarati entitled Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi No Parichaya, written by one Sri Madhavananda of Baroda. I was much delighted on reading it and became convinced that this Swami really was a Jivan Mukta. I accordingly wrote to the ashram to ask whether I could have Sri Bhagavan's darshan. After an exchange of correspondence with the ashram, I was fortunate enough to arrive there. I took darshan of Bhagavan and sat before him in the meditation hall. I was very eager to receive from him the inner or silent initiation of which I had read, and I wrote out a request for this which I placed on a small table beside his couch. Bhagavan read it and then placed it in one of his books. I was eagerly awaiting his response, but he just sat silently, resting his gracious gaze on me and others in the hall. After a few hours, my mind began to be oppressed by harmful thoughts and tendencies from the past, and this puzzled me a good deal. This state of affairs lasted for 2 days, and I was quite worried over it. Had my coming here done more harm than good? Then on the third day, these thoughts dissolved, and an ever-increasing peace swept over my mind. This went on for 3 days, and finally became so strong that I felt obliged to stand up before Bhagavan with folded hands and testify to having received the inner Diksha from him and been brought to a state of peace and contentment through his grace. Bhagavan looked at me and smiled. I knelt before him and he extended his right hand over my head in blessing. Immediately after this, an inner voice told me that what I had come for had been accomplished, and I could now go back to where I had come from. So I took leave of Bhagavan and left the ashram. Since that time, there is a constant awareness dimly at the back of my mind and experienced directly in the gaps between sankalpas. By the grace of Bhagavan, there is a steady conviction that only the self is, while all else is only the interplay of the gunas.
That was the end of that letter.
What?
That was the end.
Yeah. So Evelyn and Christine are coming Tuesday night.
Right, yeah.
Until Sunday.
But she'll spend Thanksgiving with her.
But she'll go away for Thanksgiving yeah. Day.
She really wishes she could be in two places at once. Mm.
Christine will stay here or go with her to
her parents? I don't know.
Her mother's house.
I don't know.
What book was this doing?
Mountain Path.
Or compilation.
Wasn't the Krishnamurti article in the last Mountain Path?
Was it an article or a letter?
It was the same.
It was a letter, right?
Yeah.
Or was it?
Yeah, it was a letter.
Yeah.
The last one that came?
No, it didn't. The last one that
came. Yeah, this is my time.
Yeah.
continued. Now she got the other book. When I shared that, we didn't borrow the dolly tonight. Well, you should put it back. I was going to go buy a new one. I thought we lost it.
No.
How long ago did you buy it?
Don't buy anything. Don't ask me.